If you had visited Coral Castle 60 years ago, you would have been greeted by a man weighing a mere 100 pounds, standing just over 5 feet tall. And he would have asked you for 10 cents and introduced you to the fantasy of a world carved out of stone. And as you moved around, looked around, you couldn't help but notice Edward Leed Skullman and his work. You know, since it's documented that no one really ever witnessed Ed's labor in building his rock park, some say that he had some strange powers indeed. Ed would only say that he knew the secrets used to build the ancient pyramids, and that if he could learn them, you could too. In a moment, our special guest tonight, Joe Bullard, on Coast to Coast AM. Joe Bullard was born in Florida in 1951. Makes him younger than me, the scallywag. He attended the University of West Florida and graduated with a bachelor's degree in journalism in 1974. He found out about the Coral Castle on the television series, remember this one, In Search Of. That was in September of 84. Joe spent 10 years of research at Coral Castle and started writing Waiting for Agnes in February of 1995. It took him 5 years to get the story on paper and almost 4 years to publish it. We'll talk to you about that in a second. Joe, how are you? Welcome back.
Thank you so much, George. It's a pleasure to be back.
My pleasure indeed. And Coral Castle, I'm telling you, over the years that we've talked to you and some other people have gone out there, still captures everybody's imagination, Joe.
George, there's more people coming forth now. I was just telling Tom that as I was going back tonight or this last week preparing for the show, I've got notes spread all over my floor and walls here. So if you hear me scrambling for paper, when you ask me a question, I have found notes and stuff that I made, George, over the years that I had forgotten about even existed, going back to some really weird things. And tonight I want to cover everything, look under every rock. And some of these things I'm going to tell you are strange and weird, but that's why we study Coral Castle.
Well, Joe, we're going to look under every rock. We're going to need Ed Leed Skullman to come back and help us lift some of them, huh?
Yeah, and his anti-gravity machine, if we can figure it out.
Before we get into Coral Castle, I want to get you, because, you know, when you were on with me a couple of years ago, I did ask you this question, and that was, because you've studied Coral Castle, what is your interpretation of the pyramids, the ones at Giza, and how they were built?
George, I've studied all those things, not with the mind of a scientist, but just trying to figure it out, you know, what would it have taken to build those pyramids? And from what I can determine, and you know, there's a story told of a dead cat that they found inside the pyramid, the Great Pyramid there. He had been dead for something like 20 years, and his body had actually mummified. And they found out the reason was there's a magnetic force that's set up when you set the Great Pyramid on the true north compass. It actually causes a magnetic force to be functioning inside the Great Pyramid. Well, what that magnetic force does, George, is it pulls the water out of the body, which mummified it. So if you really look at the Great Pyramid as a scientific instrument, that's how it was designed. And I believe with all my heart that somehow, we touched a little on this, that someone came down, because the math involved to do the Great Pyramid, you know, I'm not, math and science were my worst subjects in here. I am trying to explain the Great Pyramid. But looking at it, the math that's required, that, you know, that it's set on the geodetic center of the Earth. The Great Pyramid is like, if it was a body, it would be located where the navel is. Someone put that there as a scientific instrument, not as a tomb. And there's evidence now that it is a scientific instrument. And I believe that, as we talked before, someone came in, whether they were Atlanteans, whether they were aliens, someone had the technology to put that thing together that we have lost in time.
Okay, now we go to Coral Castle. We're going to talk about ley lines. We're going to talk about how Leed Skullman moved Coral Castle. But more importantly at this point, Joe, let's talk about the man, Edward Leed Skullman, a frail man, 100 pounds, 5 feet tall, maybe an inch or so higher. Who is this guy? Who was he?
Ed, to start his story off, it begins in Latvia, which borders Russia. Ed was born to a family of farmers, but I found out, I think his his real love and his real knowledge and learning came from his grandfather. You know, usually, George, we inherit some type of talent from some genetic person that we had, whether we come in as a carpenter or a movie star or whatever, something we usually inherit from someone. Ed's father was a farmer, and he grew up in the area there of Latvia, and there's a lot of rock quarries there. And Ed, as a child, was taught by his grandfather. He loved to read. He was sickly as a child. Ed was not able to go out and play like most children too much because he had sort of like asthmatic symptoms. And as you said, he was only 5 feet, 100 pounds, and he was a little bit frail. Now, as he grew later on, he got a little more muscular and a little more meat to his bones, but he was a pretty sickly person, so he read a lot of books. And I'm convinced that his grandfather had brought him actually books from all over the place. And now this section in Latvia where he is at near Riga, which is the capital, he would have had access to a lot of stuff that maybe wasn't when he came to Homestead. He didn't have the book knowledge that he had. I think he gained a lot of his knowledge as a child in Latvia reading these books because he'd sit in bed when he couldn't go to school. And he actually got, like Einstein, he got bored with school. He actually quit in the fourth grade. Well, when he was 26 years old, because he was sickly, he never dated that much. He fell in love with a girl named Agnes Scuffs. The year was 1912. The Titanic sank, and he's 26, and he meets a 16-year-old girl. The story that I got was he was in the tombstone business, carving tombstones, because that was their business, he and his grandfather. Well, she came in with her mother, you know, wearing a red dress and parasol, just a beautiful girl. Well, he was smitten. Well, it's hard to say, George, because he never explained a whole lot to anybody about the relationship of Agnes and him. And that's one thing I wanted to find out so much in my research. But we don't know how long they dated, but we know they got engaged. They were, you know, in love and ready to be married. Well, the night before the wedding, now I've heard several stories, and several recent stories. I've spoken to some friends in Latvia, and they said, well, some people say that they actually had the church wedding, and everything was ready, and she didn't show up at the church. Now, other people say that she sent her cousin by to Ed's home to tell him that she couldn't marry him. Didn't really give him a reason. Some people later on said that he was too poor and too old, but I think later on Ed had sort of made that story up. And so she jilts him the night before the wedding, and he was devastated. Like I said, only girl that he's ever loved. He's just, you know how that first love is, and he just, the rejection just tore him up. So he jumps on a boat, heads to Canada, and starts working in a lumber mill.
So he decides he's leaving that area.
He's got to get out of Latvia. Yeah. Too many memories, and he never sets foot in Latvia again. After he spends about 4 years working in the lumber mill, he starts getting sick and coughing, and he's not sure what's wrong, but he says, you know, I can't take this cold weather anymore. He had actually wanted to honeymoon in Florida years ago. So 1918, he jumps on a boat, comes to Florida to begin a new life. And this is where he's found on the side of the road by a real estate man named Moser. Well, they find George, he's got tuberculosis, and it's at the advanced stage.
Oh, my.
The actual medical report that is in the museum there in Coral Castle, the doctor states, and I got this right out of the book there, it says, Ed, your body is eaten up with tuberculosis.
I had a story just a couple days ago, Joe, with a guy who has tuberculosis, a very, very resistant strain, and they've got him in jail.
Yeah.
To keep him away from people.
It's very contagious. The people who took him in took a big chance. Now, one advantage they had, George, down there, they had porches in the old days, a screen porch. And they left him on the screen porch with plenty of air blowing through.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that helped him to recover. But you know the story I was telling you last time, he actually went out and built a sun couch, mounted it on the wheel bearings of the 1918 Ford truck, and actually spun around in the hot sun from 1 to 3. And there's some other devices that I think he may have used, like a tripod of pyramid poles there to set up that energy thing like we talked about in the Great Pyramid. And when he went back to the doctor 6 months later, he is the only person to beat advanced stage tuberculosis in history.
Remarkable.
His body was totally cured.
So he's in Florida. Where is he? Where specifically?
He actually came to Miami at first, and he hitchhiked down to Florida City, which is about a 40-minute drive from Miami. And the man actually found him in Florida City, and that's where Ed started to build Coral Castle.
All right, how old is he at that time?
He is 26 years old at this time.
All right, he's young.
Young.
Yeah, all right. He did, now, was he a Mason in Latvia? Or he just oh, he was a Mason. Okay.
Yeah. He actually learned to stone, to quarry the stones, and actually to finish the stones. You know, there were guys that just worked in the quarry, they beat the rocks out, but he was actually taught the art of actually finishing the blocks too.
Okay, so he decides he's going to build Coral Castle. Where, in Florida City?
In Florida City. Yes. And the really strange thing, George, and Ed was such a man for details, but here's the funny thing. When he was telling the Mosiers, he said, "Look, I want some land." He didn't actually tell them about Agnes, but he said, I'm building this for my Sweet 16, okay? That was what he referred to Agnes.
That's what he called her. Okay.
Right, his Sweet 16. He always referred to her. Well, Moser kept telling him, you know, bringing him. He knew Ed was from a family of farmers, so he thought, well, Ed wants to farm. So he took him around to these different areas where the best land was. Well, Ed always rejected it. And Ed said, well, I want to go to a junkyard because I want to make some tools to build my castle. And so Moser thought, well, okay, takes him to the junkyard. Well, mm-hmm. Ed finds this old bicycle. There's no tires on it, okay? So he starts riding around Homestead in Florida City. Homestead's 10 miles from Florida City. So he's riding all around on this bicycle with no tires. So that's
just on he's just on the rims.
On the rims. And they called him Crazy Ed. Well, one day he ran back into Moser's office and he said, I have found the land I want. This is where it's at. It's perfect. So Moser goes out with him, and when they look at the land, Moser goes, oh, my God, he had picked the worst land in the state, George. There's 3 inches of topsoil there. The coral bedrock goes down 4,000 feet. So Ed...
And did Ed know that?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, because he always laughed because people would say, why do you always reject the best farmland? He never would answer them. He would only smile, just keep riding his bicycle. Now, one thing that people overlook when they're telling the story is that Ed went out and cut a witching rod, okay, which you know is in those days they'd use an old oak limb with a Y-shaped fork on it, and as you found water, it would pull the rod. The
for dowsing, head. Right?
Right, for dowsing. Well, he went out, and this land that he found had water on it, and he went along and marked the lines where the water was, and this is very important. He would stick little sticks down, so he had like a map of where the water lines ran. Well, this was a place where he decided he wanted to build it. So he begins building the Coral Castle after he's cured himself of TB. Well, Moser gets curious, and he rides back out to the land 3 weeks after Ed's there, he and his wife, on a Sunday afternoon. Well, it's hot down in South Florida. As they pull up, Ed is already watching them from the woods. No one could ever catch him at work, George. Usually he only worked from midnight till 6. Now, he was raising his first stone here at Florida City. So he's out there. He has no shirt on. When the Mosiers walk up on him, there's a tripod with the chain hanging down, and in this chain is a 10-ton block of coral stone. One mistake I made last time, George, when you asked me, and I can't believe I made this mistake because I know better, but you asked me if this coral rock is actually limestone, and it is limestone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much related to the Great Pyramid because, as you know, the outer casing of the Great Pyramid is limestone also.
Yes, exactly. Now, Sweet 16, which some say was the nickname of Agnes, could have been a code, could it not?
There has been a lot of speculation, especially of recent, that the Sweet 16 was a code. I was actually sent some material by a young man named James Comer, who's a movie director, and he's done some work on Superman 2 and all those, and he believes that Sweet 16 was a code that may have been used to hide what Ed was doing. And, you know, while I don't discount any of these ideas, but I believe in my heart, George, and if you read Ed's writings, the way he talked of Agnes and the way when he was first doing it, I have to believe that Agnes existed. Now, I'm not saying that it couldn't be a code because it very likely could be, but because he could, a lot of times he would do two things. He would use it as a code, and he would also, you know, actually have Agnes as his girlfriend because be speaking about two different things about the same time. So he was very mysterious in this way. So it's absolutely possible that it could be a code. And this code has really not been deciphered yet. It's in different forms, but it's not really something we totally understand yet.
Now, let's talk about the location first and foremost. Ley lines, which are still hypothetical, you know, are these supposed alignments of a number of different places of geographical interest, first suggested in 1921 by an archaeologist by the name of Alfred Watkins.
Mm-hmm.
Did Ed Leedskalden have knowledge of these so-called ley lines, and did he pick that specific spot because of that or because the coral, the limestone?
Well, I think it was a combination of both. I think he knew that the coral, the limestone was there because, you know, why? He could have laid on the beach in Miami if he wanted to, but instead he comes to a small, you know, isolated town like Florida City where the bedrock goes down the deepest. So he had to have known it, George. And if you listen to the words of B.J. Cathy, who's written Harmonic Grid Theories, Ed claimed to know the secrets of the Great Pyramids of the Yucatan area, the Peru, and he also claimed, he said, I know the secrets of anti-gravity. So I'm convinced that this grid line, I think that Ed had an old map that he brought with him from Latvia. But this is only pure speculation, where it showed these grid lines, because if, I've seen televised pictures of B.J. Cathy's map, and it almost looks like that ley line runs from Africa, the continent of Africa, all the way across the ocean, right across through Bimini and all that, right to where Florida City and Homestead intersect.
So
Ed
now
had to have known that.
All right, so he uses that, possibly. Does he construct the entire coral castle in Florida City?
It's almost completed. In about 1936, then there's a lot of different stories. But the story that I got, George, and we'll have to talk later on about the magnet machine that he, I call it the magnet machine. It's a perpetual motion holder. It uses magnets to produce electricity. He actually invented this machine, applies for a patent on it, and he's all confident that he's going to get this patent. So he actually puts the plans in a little pamphlet and starts distributing it to everybody and says, you know, don't worry about copying it because I'm going to get a patent on it. Well, the government never issued him a patent. And the government sent three different times. They sent three different agents in there. Now, this was a time right before World War II. Everything was kind of, you know, people were spooky and, you know, war was coming on the horizon. Now, Ed's machine would have been very, very advantageous if our army or if we could have had knowledge of it. So they sent guys in there to discover Ed's secret. Well, he would not give up the secret. He said, look, I don't care who you are. This is my secret. I'm not telling you how it operates. He just wasn't, he didn't want to give away his secrets. Well, right after this, George, he was beaten within an inch of his life. The thugs came into Coral Castle one night. They caught him alone and almost beat him to death. Now, these people that I spoke to said, well, the thugs, some people said they were looking for a treasure map. But now, Ed never had any money. When he left behind Coral Castle, he left behind, you know, hundreds of dollars, but he never spent the money. He didn't love money. He loved knowledge because he was a scientist. So the idea that they actually robbed him for money, I don't think is correct. I think
whatever happened to his patent plans?
Well, the government would write to him and they'd say, well, you need to send the machine up here and let us look at it. Well, my God, it had taken him quite a long time to construct it, and he was not about to send it up there. And they knew that. They didn't want to see the machine. They knew it had a possibility of working. And so they never would. Every time he wrote to them, they'd say, well, you know, you haven't sent it to us. You haven't proven, well, these plans are not complete. They always put him off, George. Never,
okay, but,
ever.
But has anyone ever seen the plans that he submitted?
You know, I've had several people ask me to do a patent search on that. And I think that there have been people who've tried to do a patent search on it. And someone who's reported back to me said they never could find, they said it should be in the records. They said they never could find anything where that he had applied for a patent. So I don't know if those records got lost or, you know,
stolen
or just, you know, conveniently lost. So, and I didn't really have time to go into the patent search, but I think it would be great if someone could check those patents out. But the thing is, he still got the plans. After he got you know, he couldn't get the patent. He got frustrated. He said, well, look, I'm going to draw these plans up so, you know, you can build this. The problem is, George, the plans are so complicated. They're like Einstein's theory.
Well, let's talk about the machine when we come back too, Joe. Now, there's so many different facets of Coral Castle that we're going to talk with Joe Bullard about tonight, author of Waiting for Agnes. Joe, let's get back to the machine again if we can. Can you describe what it looks like?
Yes, George. It would be about the size, I would say, well, here in the South, we used to use an old wash tub to wash our clothes with, so, or an old washing or washing machine would be a good description of it. And in the center of this washing machine, if you will, there's a cloverleaf design of iron. And around this iron, George, you're going to have like magnets wrapped in just thousands of miles of copper wire. Now, there's an old handle, like they used to crank the old trucks and cars in the 1920s.
Right.
There's a handle on top of this, and this is a circular. You would start it and rotate it like a watch face. You would roll this thing, and it would circle. Now, Ed said, as you put these magnets into motion, he said, what happens is the North and the South Pole magnets start chasing each other, and once they start chasing each other, they never stop. Now, he would have a little copper wire there if he wanted to break the charge here, the connection. That's the only way, he said, you can stop it. Now, when he was talking about this machine, George, and there's parts of this machine that are missing. No one knows exactly what's happened over the years, but after he died, there was quite a bit of robbery that went on there. And they believe that a lot of the parts were missing, or they don't know exactly what happened, but... this machine, he said, you could put this in the rocket, in the head of a rocket. He said you could fly to Pluto and have breakfast, come back to the Earth that night and have dinner, and you would have more energy than you used because of the magnetic energy.
Now, where was this machine physically located there?
Okay, physically, now, Ed was living in a tower there. There's 240 tons of coral block stone. It looks like a square. If you will, and the top was his living quarters, and below it was his tool room. So this would have been right below where he actually lived. There would have been a coral block floor in between, like a two-story apartment, if you will. And, George, I was the last time I was there, I was thinking, and I don't know why it didn't dawn on me, but I looked up at the roof. The roof is flat now on this two-story apartment, if you can imagine it. And I thought, well, how did he put the blocks up there, you know, so that they don't fall on your head.
Right.
And I'm not
he had a system.
Yeah, I'm not a contractor, but I got to thinking, now wait a minute. There's no steel rod enforcements up there, you know, like you would pour concrete. It's just blocks.
Now, the tripod that we have seen, the big picture of the tripod with Ed there,
right,
hoisting stuff. Do you think that was used merely for balance and positioning once he did whatever he did to move the blocks?
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible that he used it for that method. You know, there's a lot of theories, of course, that now the photographs that you see of Ed working is one of the curious things to me because, you know, George, as we talked last time, and this is verified by the people who knew him. He had a sixth sense. When you tried to sneak up on him working, he would always stop. And if he should be working and he was going to allow you to come up, he would go over and cover his tools before he would allow you to approach.
Right. Okay? See, I think this tripod picture is a diversion.
Well, yes, I think you're right. Because now he had an old box Brownie camera with a self-timer on it. Okay, he took all his own photographs. That means that if he took these photographs, he took them himself, or if he allowed someone to take these photographs, and he's so secretive, why would he allow someone to photograph him when he was working if he didn't want this to be seen? So your idea on it's a diversion, then see, later on people would look at the photograph, and there was a lot of people who were fooled by this, and they'd say, well, my God, you see him there in the photograph, he's working with a hoist and chain, he just did it with a pulley.
Yeah, exactly, without thinking about the weight and everything else that goes behind it.
Right, and his hoist was only for 10 tons, and his heaviest stone weighed 30. So where's the math?
So let's assume for a moment, Joe, that his magnetic machine is in full motion. I wonder if the fact that it was in there by the apartment, if it just generated some kind of a field around the entire area where everything became lighter than light, for example. So it really didn't matter if this machine had to be above a block or wherever it might be. Maybe he made the entire region that way.
Yes, and when you say made the entire region that way, that's entirely plausible, because if you're already working with a point that, you know, like we talked about before with the harmonic resonance or the harmonic grid there, you've already got a point that's got it there. So if you use something to enhance that point, then you can do the whole area. Like you say, you don't have to worry about one particular section because you just unify the whole section of the grid there.
Didn't he wear iron shoes or something like that?
Yes. You know, George, and this is, I told you when I was first studying this thing, I stopped by an old gas station there to ask some questions, and the gas station, the sign up over the station said J.T. Bullard. And I was like, this can't be. This was a station in 1930. Mr. Bullard actually pulled up, and we began talking, and this is where I got a lot of the information, you know, for my story.
No relation, huh? No.
Well, we're all related similarly, you know, because we all came from Ireland, Scotland, Britain,
right,
and all those places.
Okay.
But I had a lady named Sharon Bullard who emailed me. We talked last time about we'd love to dig up some people who were actually children when they watched these stones,
right,
as we talked about being floated. Well, she said, my father-in-law was Bill Bullard. He was one of the sons or one of the children who was there and saw the stones being floated. Now, he reported that Ed wore iron soles on his shoes. And, I said, why? And she said, well, they kept him from floating. In our last interview, you asked, you said, I can't believe he didn't float off from the whole place.
Right, right.
And now she said, well, he actually went to the shoemaker and had them put, they took car bumpers, believe it or not, from the junkyard and told the shoemaker to put iron soles on his shoes because he was tired of wearing the leather soles out. But she said there was a reason for it, in that by wearing these iron soles, he was able to work in the area without floating away.
Now, that is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
But you see, George, he's so clever. When he goes to the shoemaker, he says, oh, I'm tired of wearing out my leather shoes.
Exactly. Yeah, you can't tell him why he wants them.
Right.
Okay, so he makes Coral Castle in Florida City, but then he decides he's going to move it. Was it because of the beating?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
The area had become a little bit congested. Ed was the kind of person, he totally wanted his privacy. And but now also there's theories, and Ray Stoner mentions it in his book, The Enigma of Coral Castle, that Ed had made a surveying error in Florida City. And George, one thing I think, I don't know if we talked about this last time, but these tsunamis, or anytime you have an earthquake, we're discovering that the shifting or the vibrating of the earth can change these harmonic grids or these resonance. And the idea was that the source of power there, the grid, was fading, and Ed had made a mistake, and he should have been 10 miles over in Homestead. So he kind of, it's not that he made up the story about him leaving because of the thugs. He used that, but there's also a theory that says stronger grid point in Homestead. So he calls up a friend of his, brings over a Mack truck. Now, this is one of the things that people used to ask me about. Said, well, how in the world can you carry a 30-ton stone on a truck and trailer without having a blowout? Because Ed is going to move Coral Castle from Florida City to Homestead, 10 miles away, and he trucks each stone one by one down Key West Highway to Homestead. Well, I have found out now that they were using an old Mack truck, and these tires actually were solid rubber. And that's why they didn't have blowouts.
Popped. Okay. And how did he get the blocks of stone on the truck?
Well, that's the big question. He actually hired a man to help him. This was the first time he ever asked for help in his life. Now, he told the man pulled up there and said, well, what do you want me to do? And Ed said, well, we're going to move this whole castle, 1,100 tons, 3 million pounds of stone. And, of course, the guy was kind of like, what? And Ed said, look, pull up here to this stone, and please go around to the back of the castle. Come back in about an hour, and I'll have the truck loaded for the first load. Well, the man waited and waited, and then he remembered that he'd forgotten his lunch pail. So he thought, well, I'll have an excuse, and I'll kind of sneak back up and see what Ed's doing. Well,
right.
When he low-crawled around the corner, kind of like an alligator. Well, when he came back up, Ed was standing there waiting on him, and the truck was loaded.
Already ready to go.
Already ready
Amazing.
To go.
Amazing. Amazing. So he uses some technique. He moves the blocks onto the truck. Nobody can figure out what's going on. He heads for Homestead, right?
Right.
Now,
right.
Did he live at Coral Castle?
Oh, yes. He lived on the grounds the whole
time. Did he have running water? Did he have electricity?
No. Now, that's an interesting point and something we didn't really talk about that much last time. Now, remember he's on a 4,000 feet down bedrock. Now, George, this is amazing. He goes at the location in Homestead and digs down somehow 6 feet into the solid rock there and finds a well. So he had well water there, and he actually put a little, bucket where you drop it with the rope and the crank handle. So he had fresh water from this well, and he also used it for a storage. He would get the old mason jars, and he'd put up string beans, and, you know, people always ask me, well, how did he eat? How did he live? Well, he lived out of his garden. Sometimes he'd trap a rabbit or, you know, something like that. But he mainly kind of ate vegetables, and he had a little refrigerator right there. And that's the steps. He actually has steps that go down into the well, George, and these are carved from one piece of stone.
Jeez. One piece?
One piece. As he goes down, it's this little spiral kind of staircase, and he actually had a huge stone, like a merry-go-round, that he would roll over the opening so children couldn't come down and fall into it.
Okay, so he's assembling, then, the blocks back in Homestead. Is anybody trying to see what's going on, or,
yes.
Or where's the land? I mean, is it that private?
Well, it's private. This is if you were to go back in that time and look, you would see down here in Florida, we have what we call scrub pines and like a scrub area, which will mean there'll be a little bit of lowland grass and then there'll be pines. Now, Ed selected this area also because the pines that he needed, a lot of people have asked me, well, did the tripods there, what kind of wood were they made of? Was any special wood, you know, did that help him in any way? All the pines or the poles that he would use would have been heart pine because they were readily available. And those telephone poles, some of them were 30 and 40 feet tall, okay? So he would have used that in that area. And people did try to sneak up on him at first. And after a while, what he would do is he had these little corners in the castle, and he would step up on the wall. People would be 100 yards out there, George, in the woods, using binoculars. He would know they were there. He would stand up on the wall, and he would say, how are you doing tonight? You know, he said, look, you guys make me nervous. I can't work until you go back. He
was always polite, though, wasn't he?
Always polite. Never wanted to ruffle any feathers. Because you got to remember, here he is. He's from Latvia. He's, you know, still a foreigner. And now, his English was good, but he still had a slight accent, and people were very suspicious. So he never wanted to ruffle feathers. Plus, that was just his personality. He was not someone to confront people. They said he never swore. They said he never saw him lose his temper, always cool and calm.
Okay, once this was going on and people were trying to sneak around and look at him, did anybody from any newspaper ever do a story on him while he was there, while he was alive?
Yes, there were several newspaper interviews. And in fact, one of them said, that he was, I think it's the headline said something like, castle builder lives to build the castle for his Sweet 16. And they talked about him, you know, being sick and waiting for Agnes and this type of thing. So there were several articles. And actually, Ed sort of got semi-famous in that area. They took pictures of him and showed him sitting at the castle. And actually, one of the newspaper articles said, the castle man doesn't need your help. Thank you very much. And the article explained how when people would come up, he would stop working. And they really went into detail about what he was doing at Coral Castle. So people from miles around started coming to see Ed in the castle.
Did any reporter speculate on how he did this?
I don't think so. At the time, it was an interesting place, but Ed was so private and so kind of reclusive out where he was that they were curious about it, George, but there were so many things going on in their lives. You know, you had farmers and you had their lives, and they didn't pay as much attention to it as they would today.
Well, what kind of reporters could they be, Joe, if, you know, he's building this incredible castle and they didn't say, hey, Ed, you're by yourself. How'd you move him?
That, well, of course, they would ask him, and he would always just politely say, well, I know the secrets of the pyramids. I know the secrets of Stonehenge. George, he was an expert at deflecting your questions. Oh, yes, they asked him all the time, but they could never get a word out of him. And after a while, two or three interviews, they learned to just say, well, instead of asking, they just say, yeah, I know. You know the secrets of the pyramids. He always gave them the same type answers. So after a while, it was like you were just beating your head against the wall. So when you went to interview him, you tried to ask him things that he might answer.
He died in 1951, I believe, right?
That's correct.
He's got to have told one person, one close friend, how he did it.
Nothing. All he would tell you, and he would say...
Did he have a close friend?
No. Well, yes, he did. There was a man named Orville Irwin, who was a close friend of his, who actually kind of documented some of the things that Ed did there in Coral Castle. But as far as a close friend, no. Ed just didn't want to, he didn't want to develop. I think the experience with Agnes, I think that he decided that he was going to work, and you got to remember the work he's doing, he doesn't really have time to socialize. Even after he builds Coral Castle, he spends his time doing radio experiments, magnet experiments. He's the kind of guy, you know, we make a joke here about watching paint dry. Well, he actually put mold in one of his pools and watched the mold grow in the sunlight. So he just didn't have time for people.
That is, how old was he when he died?
He was 64.
64 years old. He built the thing when he was in his mid-20s. So for all those years, he stayed and lived at Coral Castle?
Stayed and lived at Coral Castle. And now, here's the cool thing. At night, a lot of times, you know, you had to go up to the door there, and there was a bell, and you had to ring it twice. If you rang it three times, he said, you know, you didn't follow my instructions, so I'm not giving you a tour. So you had to do everything exactly the way Ed wanted it. But people would go by there at night, and if he wasn't working, you know, they'd ring the bell, and he'd come in, and sometimes they'd listen to music. He'd cook them hot dogs, and they said he would always, and this is why I'm so convinced, George, that Agnes existed, because he described her as radiant, well-bred, and a girl that he loved. And that you know, this was a time in his life that he'll never forget. And they said he would look out towards Latvia, look out across the ocean there and to the stars also, and he'd say, I'm telling you, one day my sweet 16 will come. And so enthusiastic. They said, you know, he talked about her so much, after a while people began to wonder, what, did she really exist, or is she a figment of his imagination?
Well, who knows? Now, yeah. What did he die of, Joe?
He actually died of malnutrition. He actually, they called it.
He probably wasn't making any money, so he didn't eat. What was his income stream?
Well, believe it or not, now, there are rumors that he had a little bit of stock in a city company there. I haven't found much evidence to that. When he died, they actually, in a pipe there that he left behind, he put a string, and there was 38 $100, crisp $100 bills.
Did he physically ever work?
Well, not
as
really.
A job then?
Not really. But if you got to remember this now, you got to remember 20 years of collecting dimes. Okay, and later on, and there's a funny story down there. There's a place where if he was not in the castle right there, but you want to put your money in there and come back later, you could actually put it in a little thing he put in there, and it said, you know, put your dimes here. And later on, when he moved the castle to Homestead, he went up to a quarter. So he left the old admission 10 cents in the old place because he didn't want people to know that he went up to a quarter. So you got to remember.
He couldn't have generated that kind of cash to survive.
Well, huh? Over 20 years, though, think about it. He had there was no taxes.
All right, hold on, Joe. We'll come back. We'll talk about this. This puzzles me. The guy was there for 40 years and never went out and had a job. Ed Leedskalden even had a health chair. We're going to talk about that, too. And much more on Coast to Coast AM. Joe's website, waitingforagnes.com, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. How did he get the money, Joe, besides just his living expenses, to buy the land and the materials and things like that?
Well, now, remember, the land that he actually bought, George, I think the original site was like 10 acres there, and I think he paid $12 for it. The site now only has like, I think, an acre or two because, of course, over the years it was auctioned off, and, you know, the castle only encompasses a smaller area there. So, like I said, $12. Yeah. And remember, George, in these days, or in those days, I should say, a dime went a long way. I mean, you know, you could buy bread, you could, you know, you could go to the movie theater, you could have popcorn, you could, the dime just went a long way. And even later on, when he was doing it, a quarter was a long way. And as I said, and I can't find any information on this, but they said that they thought they believed that he had some stock in some city utilities there somehow. That information is vague, and that he had a little monthly income from that. But as far as the cash goes, like I said, the only thing that I can determine is that his costs were very minimal. Back in those days, there were no taxes. Remember, he had his own water, the electricity that he needed. He actually he provided that for himself. So really, and a lot of people helped Ed out, you know, like ladies would bake him pies or take him food. And, you know, so a lot of the people there helped him. But as far as the actual cash goes, I've just got to think that, you know, over those periods of time, he actually saved it from the utility company that he received stocks from, and he was very miserly. All his utilities, all his tools, you know, he made handmade everything. He actually bought nothing.
Might he have had an inheritance?
Well, no. When he came here, he told the Mosers, he said, "I'm flat broke. I have nothing." He started out with nothing. Now, I have learned later on that, you know, I was thinking when I was first researching the story that he lost total contact with his family, but there's stories now that he did write back and forth to them. But as far as I know, they never sent him a dime.
All right. All right. Let's talk a little bit about this health chair. Tell us.
The health chair is something a lady emailed me after the last show, the show that we did before in March of 2004, and she said, as a little girl, she said, my mother was not really dating Ed, but she said, my mother was a teacher. She was very intelligent. And she said, Ed really liked her. And she said, now in these days, Ed was working in the sun. He had a good tan. He'd gotten his health back. And she said, you know, he was kind of a muscular little guy there. And she said, my mother was quite attracted to him. And she said, we'd go by the castle and they'd kind of flirt back and forth and talk about schools, you know, because Ed loved children. And she said, when he was giving me a tour of the castle, now, the health chair, George, as we were studying this thing, it's not really different than any other chairs, you know. Remember, there's 25 one-ton rocking chairs inside Coral Castle. They all rock on the center of their gravity. They don't have rocker arms. They're just kind of cut in a concave position. And she said Ed would take her to this chair. She was probably 6-7 years old. And he told her, he said, now sit in this chair here, and you'll have good health forever. Now, she said, I would sit in the chair for a while, and she said, but as a young child, of course, I was restless, and I wanted to play on the other chairs in the castle there. And Ed told other people every now and then. Now, he didn't really put the health chair on his tour. He didn't really include it. The health chair was behind and to the left of the mother-in-law chair. If you remember, that was the one he said he created it to be the most uncomfortable chair in the castle in case his mother-in-law, you know, visited, that she would hate the chair and take the hint and leave.
Well, now, he didn't have a mother-in-law.
Had a mother-in-law. Well, a supposed mother-in-law in the future if she came.
All right, all right.
So the health chair, I would love to find out more about that. We're wondering, George, if it's not at one of those points in the castle there where the energy level would have been on the grid, and maybe it would have been higher, because, you know, they've proven now that they actually have a magnet machine that you can get into that's a pulsating magnetic field that actually repels, you know, arthritis and all these type of things. So the only thing we can figure is that that chair is sitting in a spot on one of those, what we call a sweet spot.
Let me ask you this. Did anybody ever try to duplicate this magnetic machine that he had up there?
Well, over the years, there's several backyard inventors, and I get emails from a lot of guys all the time that are trying, and several people have gotten close, but they've never really, I think there was a company that had to move offshore near one of the, I want to say the Canary Islands, because they were kind of harassed out of this country. So they set it up down there, and they are still trying to make models of it. They're the same idea, but it's very difficult. And as far as I know, they do not have an exact working model of his machine, although they're trying.
Well, I'm always wondering if somebody's got the technology somewhere, especially if, like he said, it could propel rockets.
Yeah, and, you know, George, when you think about it, that's with the magnets running the machine, and it's always producing as much as it consumes. In fact, the idea comes like from a battery, because I think water, if you remember, water had to be present. When he found the water there, water sort of acts as a catalyst like a battery does in our car. So this machine is very plausible. And one thing I can't understand, George, is we have something here in our country that there's nothing like it. The man who discovered the secrets of the pyramids, the Mayans, all of these cultures, Stonehenge, not only does he figure that out and proves it, and Ed was not a bragger, he let his stones do the talking, but here is a machine that we should be using, we should be studying, and yet today, from, say, the University of Florida Engineering Department, or I was watching a thing on History Channel where these professors went to Italy studying these different architects, you know, from Syracuse and New York University, and I thought, why aren't these same guys, why don't they come right into our own country here, figure out what Ed's machine was, at least put the students, you know, why not run the students from the University of Florida through these classes, your engineering students, let them study. George, in Florida, 90% of the Florida residents don't know about Coral Castle. If it wasn't for people like you and Coast, I've never been interviewed by a radio station in Florida.
You're kidding me.
No, I don't even. There's only been one magazine article and one newspaper article written in Florida about my work.
Who owns the place now?
The owners of Coral Castle are quite mysterious. It's very difficult. They really don't want to be known. From what I understand, they live in Chicago, but I don't know if they're afraid of just, they don't want publicity, or they're quite wealthy. And
do you know who they are?
I really don't. I had tried to find out one time, and I was told not to ask any more questions.
What would the property tax rolls say? They've got to say something.
You could probably find it out from there. It's just that I never pursued the matter because I thought, well, if they want to remain private, you know, who am I to?
Down that way, though, aren't you?
Pardon me?
Are you down that way?
Well, no, I'm actually 8 hours. I'm an 8-hour drive. I'm almost, that's why I have this swamp accent. I'm almost into Georgia where I live.
We got to turn somebody loose on this to find out what the property tax rolls say. I mean, I'm sure it's probably in a trust or some kind of corporation, and we may never find out who it is. But who knows? Stranger things have happened. I'm really curious to see who owns it and how long have they owned it.
Well, now they've actually, I can give you a little bit of history on that. When Ed died, he had one cousin named Harry Leeds Gowan, and he was in Chicago, and he left the castle to Harry. But Harry was sick, so he sold it to a couple in Chicago. They kept it for a couple of years, and then they sold it to the owners that own it now. Okay, now you can check with the state of Florida, the history department there, and they can tell you it's a registered. It's on the National Historical Register. So you can find out from that. Like I said, I got into a little bit of trouble with the owners there, George, if you remember.
What happened?
Well, if you remember in the first book that I sent you.
And you mean the current owners?
Yes, the current owners.
Okay.
My book is not carried in Coral Castle. For anybody who calls, you're not going to find my book in any of the chain stores. You won't find it at Coral Castle. I live in an old Florida cracker house built around 1900, and I've got it stacked to the walls with my book. I'm the only one that carries it. I don't know if I've been blacklisted at the stores or what, but nobody carries my book.
So it's not sanctioned by the Coral Castle people?
No. No.
Okay,
why
not?
Well, let me – this is – I want to
give us
to,
the juicy stuff, Joe. What happened?
Okay, I'm going to air my dirty laundry here, George, just for you. Okay, as I was researching this story – and I remember I spent like 10 years just I wasn't planning on writing a book. I was just taking notes because I was so fascinated. Well, I was down in Honduras because I was looking for the Atlantis connection. I had read a lot of stories about Casey talking about Atlantis existing off the coast of Florida at Bimini, which just fascinates me because they have actually, George, found a pyramid down there that was 400 feet out of the sand. So I'm sitting here going, oh, my God. So I'm down in Honduras. Well, I find this Mayan swastika on a pyramid down there, and it's also in Mexico. It's all over the place. Now, when I say a Mayan swastika, I mean it's not exactly like Hitler's swastika.
Well, and I want everybody to know that prior to the Nazis, the swastika was a pretty commonplace emblem, wasn't it, in logo type?
Yes, it actually meant, you know, like the sun. You know, it was characterizing the sun.
Right. I mean, it's got bad connotations now, but before the Nazis took it as their slogan, basically,
right?
It was pretty predominantly used.
It was all over the place. Yes, it was
for ages.
Yes, even the Mayans had it. You know, they actually believed that the snake, when he shed his skin, he was being reborn.
Right.
And that's where you find the snake, the serpent, the plumed serpent on a lot of their pyramids. So I find this, and I'm going, oh, my God. Well, all of a sudden, Ted Danson comes out with this television series in a movie called, Back to Atlantis. And he actually shows where Hitler ordered Heinrich Himmler to look for the master race. George, they went into Tibet. They went into Central South America, everywhere looking for the master race. And I'm like, oh, my God, what if, let's just take a wild scenario, and I was looking for a plot to add to the Ed story because, you've got, when you're writing a book, you've got to have some wheels that it can roll on. And I looked at Ed's coming from Latvia, and where does he land? He lands at an area of Florida at the edge of the Everglades. They actually say the tip of the Bermuda Triangle actually goes into that area. So I'm going, oh, my God, we got Atlantis, we got the Bermuda Triangle, we got that city out there. Now, 10,000 years ago, George, which a lot of people don't realize, all that water was dry land.
Exactly.
So the city could have sat right there. So as I'm researching this, I find the swastika, and I think, oh, my God. So I based a lot of this on Casey's writings because he said they misused the crystal powers. They actually had a generating plant, and they had like a laser-type war, like a Star Wars-type war that destroyed it. So I'm sitting here going, what if? And they're doing a lot of studies now, and we talked about, and you talked about a past life in your newsletter there when you wrote an article on my book and our interview. Mm-hmm. I loved how you said, hey, you know, what if Ed discovered he did have a past life? And they're doing studies now called genetic memories where our DNA could go back all the way. In other words, there could have been an Adolf Hitler 10,000 years ago in Atlantis, and 10,000 years later, he comes back in our era, the same exact guy, maybe different name, but that same DNA is in the blood. So my plot in the book, George, is to go back in Atlantis and see what happened there. And let's just say if those pyramids are that old and the swastikas are there, what if there was a form of Nazis? And what I was trying to show, George, was let's look out, because evil that's in the past always comes back, and it kind of repeats itself like a circulating pattern. So in the book, the reason I put the picture of the Mayan swastika was to show that this culture could have existed 10,000 years ago in this city, okay, could have been someone like Adolf Hitler. And what I was trying to do was warn the world, look out, these things can happen again. And actually in page 254 of the hardback book, I mentioned Ed was not a Nazi. He did not like these things. He was keeping up with it. And you got to remember, George, in this time period that Ed was there was one of the greatest times, and Hitler was a big part of that in the evil that he committed. So I was trying to show in the book, and I actually said, you know, we have to watch out for these cultures. But what happened was when I mailed the book to Coral Castle for them to approve it, the owners were down there for a visit. And the book was on the counter. Well, when you look in the hardback book, on third page, you see the Mayan swastika. Well, the owner picked up the book, was perusing it, saw the Mayan swastika, and went, boom, threw my book in the trash and said,
He went bananas.
He's a communist and will never carry this book in our place.
Okay, without even looking at what it was.
Without reading the book, nothing. And actually, the strange thing is my friend who actually did the first newspaper review was a Jewish friend of mine. And I ran the store by her, and I said, now, you sure you understand what I'm trying to say? She said, it's clear as a bell. you know, you have no problem. And I've actually had Jewish friends of mine who wrote me and said, hey, you know, I understand what you were doing, but this is a case, George. I'm not beating anybody up. It's a shame that I've done all this work and the book is not offered there. And I would do anything to, you know, to sit down with these people and explain to them what I was trying to say, but they will not talk to me. So I just, it's just a lost cause.
All right. So you may not be the one to track them down, but somebody at Coral Castle, is Coral Castle, I've not been there.
It's privately owned.
It's privately owned. But yes, you can go see it. You can tour it.
It's a tourist.
Yes. How much you pay to go see it now?
Now it's gone up. It used to be $6. It's about $10 now.
For $10, you go there, and I guess there's staff there.
There's
running
guides.
Around?
Yeah, there's guides, and they give you about an hour's tour there.
So somebody somewhere is the manager of Coral Castle. If you call down there, right?
Correct. Sylvia is the manager.
All right. If you call Sylvia and say, Sylvia, who owns Coral Castle? What's she going to say?
You. You will get probably, I'm not allowed to give out that information.
All right, but she does know who it is.
Of course.
So how much money do you think they're making down there now?
Actually, George, there's about...
I mean, it's not like a lot of people go there all the time.
No, it's not
like Disneyland.
No. In fact, one of the things that's hurt Coral Castle and all those places is Disneyland. You know, everybody wants to run down and see all the whiz and the bang, which is great. And Coral Castle is more of a historical, scientific thing in a way, but it's a lot of fun. You can put your kids in there. And Ed was saying, you know, I don't need hurricane insurance because Hurricane Andrew blew through there and it was still fine. I don't need fire insurance because nothing I have will burn. So kids can come through there, play up. They can't hurt anything. It's an outdoor museum, but only about, I'd say, 10 years ago, there were 75,000 visitors. There's probably a lot more. When we did the Coast Show, they packed that place, and they're still going from that show. But I would say...
So give me an estimate. How many people do you think...
I'd say 90,000.
90,000 people a year at $6.
Yeah.
Bucks. So it's generating over $500,000 in gross sales.
Right.
And I don't know what their expenses are, but...
It's probably
paying its mortgage.
Oh,
right?
For sure.
At least...
For sure, yeah, yeah. And, you know, one sad thing that I want to say is I want to run down there with a can of WD-40 and spray all of Ed's iron tools because, you know, they're not, I mean, I hate to say this, they're just not putting the money in keeping up his tools.
They're not taking care of it, are they?
No.
Maybe I get everybody from coast to coast to pitch in. And
I wish you would come down on June 21st, the summer solstice, and let's have an Ed's Day. I'm working on, you know, we have a new governor here. I didn't have any luck with the last, you know, I was telling people, George, no Florida governor, no senator, no mayor, nobody will step into Coral Castle and say it exists.
Gosh, I saw a picture of the magnetic machine, but you are right. It looks like its parts have been taken out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if you got the latest email I sent you. A wonderful photographer named Robert Wyman took a picture of the actual stone. Did you see that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure did.
Mm-hmm. The gray matter there, the stone that sits under the 9-ton gate. I couldn't take that good a picture.
Right.
But yeah, George, there's so much that could be done there, and the knowledge that could be gained from this place, it's just being wasted.
Well, we're going to continue talking about some of the magnificent things that Ed had at Coral Castle. But also what I'd like, Joe, next hour when we open up the phone lines, maybe somebody has some inside information on the Coral Castle, like the woman who called you after listening to your appearance on Coast to Coast in 2004. Maybe someone out there has had relatives who know about Coral Castle. Maybe someone out there was told the secret by Ed Leedskalden. We'll be back.
Let's hope so.
Joe, our researchers, our listeners, sent me some information on Coral Castle, the taxes. First of all, the taxes in 2006, $27,578. And the owner's name is just listed as Coral Castle, Inc. So that is that. Now what somebody would have to do is send a letter to the Secretary of State in Florida to get the information on the corporation, or at least find the attorney who's responsible for it, and then you track down the owners. But, you know, if you're paying property taxes of $27,000, that place is worth, you know, $2.5 to $3-4 million.
Oh yeah, at least.
You know, so that's a pretty good chunk of property. And what is it on? How many acres?
I think the site now has only got like an 2 acres. I think it's on 2 acres.
Okay, and I don't think the taxes have been paid yet.
Hmm.
For 2006.
Okay.
And they have to pay them by May 31st, or then they start paying those penalties and things like that.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It?
That's, like I said, when I got in trouble, I kind of just laid low, and I really haven't talked about it. This has really done the first time because, you know, George, I wouldn't hurt anybody's feelings in this world. And you know, I understand they lost some family members during the Holocaust. And, you know, George, if there was one person out there who thought I was a Nazi, I would destroy my book. I would quit all my research. I wouldn't do anything that was remotely connected to that. And I'm so sad that that's the thought there. But I thank you for letting me clear the air here with the listeners and the anyone who bought that original book. You know, I've never had any other complaints.
Okay, back to Coral Castle, back to Ed Lead Skolnin. So he dies, where does he die? In a hospital? Does
Jackson
he die
Memorial,
there?
Jackson Memorial Hospital. In 1951, in December of 1951, Ed had not been eating correctly. And, you know, some of the people that told me there, in fact, Mr. Bullard said that he was tired. He had done everything he wanted to do, and he was just basically, to quote Mr. Bullard, he was ready to go. He got on his bicycle, pedaled over to the local bus station, bought a ticket to Jackson Memorial Hospital, checked into the hospital there. And they said that he went into a coma, that as he got there, he was very sick, and the doctors described his condition as very, very weak. And they said he went into a coma, and they said he kind of came in and out of it, and 3 days later he died in 1951. And, you know, that's when the period that he was in the hospital, some thieves broke into Coral Castle there and looted it and, you know, destroyed some of the stuff. And like I say, that's when some of the parts of the machine went missing. So we don't know what went on there.
Now, when we say thieves, how do we know they weren't people of authority? Here's an example. Nikola Tesla dies. His office gets raided and all his plans are taken away for free energy or harnessing energy from, you know, the solar system and from space. And so how do we know this didn't happen to Ed?
It's almost a no-brainer that it did happen that way. And the best way to cover that is to say, you know, thieves broke in. Well, what were they going to steal? He never didn't have any money there except for what he hid there, and they didn't know about that. So what could they really steal? His crystal radio set? There was really nothing there, so it's almost apparent that it was looted and for a reason.
Yeah. Of everything you've investigated, Joe, I know the book is Waiting for Agnes's fiction based on fact.
Right.
But what has perplexed you the most, fascinated you the most about Lead Skolnin or the Coral Castle?
Oh, gosh, George. I could spend 2 hours. There is so many things there that, like the rock telescope and the sundial, and one of the things, I think the thing that gets me the most is here is a man supposedly with no education, fourth grade education, and he wasn't just a Mason, George. He was what I love the most is he was a scientist, and he did his own work. He proved his own things. He never wasted anything. For example, when he was digging his first trench to try to get down to the bedrock, he didn't waste the soil, George. He every little piece of gravel and sand, he separated it into different piles for use in something later on. So what gets me about the man is he, just like the Native Americans, when they shot a buffalo, they used his foot, his tail, his tongue. That was the key and the secret to what made Ed different than everybody else, and his eye for detail. George, he loved, and I'm a kid at heart. I'm the same way. We have lizards here in Florida, the little green ones that run around, and I watch them and spiders. I'm particularly fascinated by spiders, and so was Ed.
You can have them.
Yeah. Well, he used to catch flies and throw them in the webs there down there just to, you know, watch the spiders come in and watch how they – he loved them because they were engineers. You know, if they watched their webs. So he was such a person, and he spent, remember, a lot of time alone. And I guess I'm an only child, so I did a lot of the same things he did. I had to entertain myself. And I found so much that I related to him. Of course, I mean, I don't have the brain that he had, but his knowledge and his ability to decode things, I think, is what people have no concept. And the thing was, George, he never bragged. He never said, you know, look at all these things I've done. And, George, you could write a 1,000-page volume on the delicate interest. Well, I'll give you an example. He took his watch in to be cleaned one time, and the watchmaker down there said when he took the watch apart, the spring had actually broken there, and Ed had heated the ends of it and connected it back inside the watch exactly. The only thing kept it from running was cleaning it. The watchmaker said only a few watchmakers in the world would have had the finesse to do that. So the man can cut stone and yet fix a watch.
A minute little thing.
A minute thing. And he was an artist. He was a sculptor. He was a scientist. Much in the form of Da Vinci and all the great inventors. And I think the thing that captivates me also, George, is that here we have this amazing man. Like we talked about last time, Einstein was genius, but he never lifted 30-ton stones. Why has the man been forgotten? And that still bothers me to this day, and I think it's what drives me, George. And one thing I'll mention about Agnes and the reason I think she existed, from what I can understand, her mother was very opposed to the marriage because she didn't feel that Ed was of the highest quality. And if you remember, Ed described Agnes as being well-bred,
right,
which means she came from a better family.
Some kind of royalty, maybe, of Latvia at the time?
Exactly. I think so. And I think that this drove Ed. You know, if you look at all the geniuses, they said one thing that fascinated Einstein, one thing that they said, well, what was the one thing that clicked in his mind that made him go into all these different theories? And they said one simple thing, the compass.
The compass.
And they said, why? And he said, here's a force that moves a needle that I don't understand. Okay, so that drove him. So what drove Ed, I think, to succeed more than anything else? And they said when he got done at Coral Castle, one of the things he did was he would tell people on the tour, now look, don't ask a lot of questions until I get through with the tour because I want to be able to finish the tour. But when he got done, he would stand on a stone platform and just beam and grin like, you know, look at this that I've done. And he would say, now you can ask any questions you want, do anything you want to do, the place is yours. He was so proud of it, George. And I think he was finally standing on that platform saying, okay, Agnes's mother, look what you threw away.
What did the inside of his living quarters at Coral Castle look like?
Oh, this is great. And he would never allow anyone into his quarters. Okay, that was very private, and he would not allow it. And a lot of words were, well, is he storing his treasure map in there? You know, what is this guy doing? Why? Well, he gives a tour, but he won't let us go in to see what his living quarters were like. Well, when you walk in his living quarters, George, remember now, in the time he had tuberculosis, he actually took his bed. Now, he took a couple of two-by-fours, or I guess I should say four-by-fours. He covered them in burlap bags, strung them together, nailed them together there, and then he hung the whole thing from chains from the ceiling. Now, there was two purposes of this. He would sleep at an angle so that fluid would not build up in his lungs, okay? And also, later on, when someone asked him about it, he said, you know, I'm a bachelor, so I have to do all the cooking and cleaning. And he said, so I don't want to sweep under my bed, so I keep it suspended from chains in the daytime to sweep under it. Now, inside here, you've got to remember, now, this is rough coral stone in there, okay, that's been smoothed into blocks. Okay, now, he went to the junkyard. Remember, all his tools came from there. Well, he took the bumpers off of cars, and I still don't know how he did this. But when you look in the corner there, you know how people build little corner racks there? Well, his corner racks consisted of car bumpers that are inserted into the walls. He would actually climb up on the walls there, and he had jars of string beans and potatoes and all the stuff from his garden in the mason jars that he didn't have in the refrigerator down there. When he was ready to eat, he would have all these on his walls, okay? Then he had a little two-burner stove in there, a little kerosene stove. Now, above the stove, here's one of the most fascinating things at Coral Castle, and this is what I love about his genius. Now, remember in Latvia, they didn't have the bugs. George, we've got cockroaches down here in Florida that fly. I mean, they look like, you know, 747s.
Gosh.
Ed was not prepared for all these bugs. And in the old days, they had what they called a pie safe. And you put your food in this pie safe, but the bugs would still get in it. So Ed's solution to the bugs, he puts an iron cable up in the ceiling, and he builds his pie safe suspended in the air. Now, on this cable, about midway, he puts a funnel, and he attaches the funnel to the wire, and then he puts tar around the bottom of the funnel and fills it with kerosene. So here's the funnel in the middle of the wire. So a bug would have to crawl down the wire, and as he's trying to get to Ed's food, he drowns in the kerosene.
Brilliant.
So this was Ed's way of handling the bugs.
That was his own insect catcher.
His own insect, his own, I can't think of the name of the plant that catches the bugs, but Venus flytrap. Venus flytrap, thank you. And now his room, when you go up in there, we're only talking, George, about, I would say, oh, it's probably 10 feet wide by, gosh, 8 feet long, 8 by 10, 10 by 10, something like that. Very, very Spartan. Had his food box there, his bed. Oh, he also had a chair that he made out of horsehair and covered it in a fabric, and then he hung the chair from chains so he could sit and read at night. So his chair was suspended also in the air. So when you walk in there, everything is suspended by chains that can be.
Just, it is absolutely incredible at how this is done. Now, are there any structures like this any place on the planet?
There is nothing even remotely resembling it. Nothing.
So this could be another one of the wonders of the world, basically.
Many people, they tried to get it on the register as the eighth wonder of the world, but it never got off the ground. You know, they couldn't get the interest in it. And, George, I think here's one of the examples of what's happened there. Ed's place has been relegated to a circus, if you will, something, a sideshow, a freak sideshow. Instead of being scientifically, and, George, I went to the mainstream bookstores one time. They invited me to do a book signing. George, I'm not kidding you. I'm sitting there at one of the major chains. I don't want to mention who. The people who were coming in, they would walk over to my table and they would say, "Well, oh, what is this place? Tell me about Coral Castle." Well, as I would launch into my little spiel about him discovering and the things that we're discussing right now, George, 7 out of 10 people would walk away. They would not. They thought I was lying. They thought I had made the story up.
Or they didn't have any interest?
Oh, both.
What do you think?
Yeah. Could be. I think the shock on their face was I think they thought I was really not telling the truth. In fact, Coral Castle had such trouble convincing people that Ed worked alone. They went back to people like Orville Irving and all the people who knew Ed in the early stages. There's actually a book down there where they signed and notarized that we watched him, we saw him. He worked alone.
Even if he had 20 guys working with him,
yeah,
they couldn't do what he did.
That's correct. But people, you see, they just and another thing, they drive by the sign down there. There's not a really nice sign. They're headed to the Keys. They're in a hurry. They look over there and they see 8-foot-high gray walls. That's all you see because you can't see inside the castle really. You can see the crescent moon. That's the only visible signpost there. So they think, oh, this is just a tourist trap. And Ed said, here's the ironic thing, George, when he's building Coral Castle, there were so many tourist traps down there, alligator farms and, you know, people, you know, breathing fire. You know how Florida is. We were trying to sell everything. And Ed said, I'm going to build a place that's not a tourist trap. And ironically, fate has it that he's cast into the light as just a circus guy.
Well, let's go back to the machine for a moment. What is there anything on record again that Ed has been quoted as saying about that machine?
Not really. Not really. I can't find anything. The only thing, and I'm not sure where B.J. Cathy got the quote, but I saw an interview by him not long ago, and he made the statement. Ed said he had the secrets of anti-gravity. I never found that in any of my research anywhere. But I'm not saying he didn't say it because, you know, B.J. Cathy's been studying this a lot longer than I have. In fact, there's many people that have. But he's one of the few, and I take him at his word.
What does BJ say about the machine?
He believes that along with the Christopher Dunn theory, that there was a cable that ran from the machine out to the actual stones, and that Ed was taking that tripod, wrapping a chain around the actual end of the stone, lifting it a little bit until he got this cable around it. Then he would crank the handle on his machine, and what it was doing, George, and we talked about this last time, one thing they don't understand at Coral Castle, there is a black box that sits on top of the tripod. The stone is underneath. Now, this steel cable runs from the black box, we'll call it, all the way down, and you can see it might be wrapping around the stone, but you can't really see it in the photograph. So Christopher Dunn's idea is that Ed was actually flipping the magnetic pole of the stone by his magnetic machine. And the way this would work is the energy, the frequency would come out of his machine. It would travel up the iron rod or the iron cable, if you will. It would go up to that box. And he believes, and there are tuners that Ed left behind in the castle. And Christopher Dunn believes that those tuners in the box change the frequency, and it goes down to the actual stone and changes the polarity of that area.
Because, you know, the tripod may be able to help the blocks vertically, but it doesn't explain the mass movement horizontally of these blocks and how he got them all over the place.
That is absolutely right. And I had a guy, you know, I get all these great theories, and I don't know if this might make more sense to you, but a guy emailed me, and he said, what if there's a way to have like a 3D magnet power, if you will, go out to the sides there and form some kind of other magnetic, you know, if you can flip the poles north and south, let's try to flip them, or what can we do east and west? And this was his theory, that is there some type of magnetism that we can go side to side?
He has a message over the door of his bedroom. Tell me about it.
That is something that I have asked people over the last 20 years. There is a number that's up over that doorway there, and the number they're saying he said it says the secret to the universe, and he gives this number, and something that a lot of people have tried to decode over the years. And I've never found really an answer that explains what this code means. But one of the numbers in the code, George, is 51. And in my research, and if you look, that is the angle that the Great Pyramid is formed on. It's also the angle of one of the shadows that's at Stonehenge. So I'm wondering if this...
It's also the year he died.
That's right. It's the year he died. Good point. I hadn't thought about that. Ooh. Gives me chill bumps.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that number, we're trying to figure out, it has to be, we think, some type of astrological symbol or sign, but at this point it's unknown. If there's anyone out there who can decipher this number, they will win the ultimate prize.
Because it said, the secret of the universe is
right.
7129/61 0-5-1-9-5. Somebody's got to have a computer that can figure this one out. We'll be back in a moment with Joe Bullard. We'll take your questions. And if any of you have had relatives who might have known Ed Leeds Scullin, you can check in with us too. Okay, get paper and pen. When we come back, I will give you those numbers again that Ed apparently left over the door of his bedroom, the secret of the universe. There's that number sequence just ahead on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here are those numbers again that Ed left over the door of his bedroom. The secret of the universe, 7129/61 0-5-1-9-5. Joe, I can't believe that some mathematician hasn't tried to decode this.
George, we need more people working on this. It is amazing that, like you said, in this computer age, I mean, you know, we have things like things that are decoded all the time, and this is there's just not enough people that are aware of it. Like I said, George, I've been working on this story 23 years, and nobody in Florida even listens to me, so much less have somebody working on his secret code. They don't know the number. They don't have any idea what's going on in the greatest mystery on the planet.
This is all supposition. Where do you think Ed got his knowledge? Family? Born with it? Where do you get it?
I think born with it. I think born with it, born with a desire. I think there's a genetic connection somewhere that, you know, caused him, whether it was Agnes's rejection that was the cat, you know, that actually caused him to, you know, to study and to research this, because he had to have something innate in him, like Einstein and all of the great thinkers, that it had to be, because I think that I think he brought some books with him from Latvia, from some old time way back, because I don't think the Florida City Library, if you remember we talked last time, he spent sometimes 5 hours a day in the library studying. But I don't think the books where he gained his knowledge came from the Florida City Library, because I think it would have been too small. So I think that it's a combination. I think he was born with it. And I think like a lot of people don't do, he developed those talents and abilities to the utmost. He never wasted anything, and that was his secret.
Where's he buried?
He's buried. I wish he was buried in Coral Castle. Unfortunately, he's not. He's actually buried in a graveyard in Miami. When he died, his actual wishes were to be buried at Coral Castle, but there were complications. At that time, you know, things had changed. Cities had grown larger, and his request was denied to be buried there. I wish I had the wherewithal to go dig him up and put him where he wanted to be.
Before we go to calls, tell me a little bit about his book, Magnetic Current.
This is a book that he wrote that describes. In fact, let me give you some of the way he started this off, and I think this is fantastic. It starts off Magnetic Current, if you don't mind me reading this.
Go ahead. And is this book, I'm going to ask you about your book where you can get it in a second, but is this book, Magnetic Current, available?
Oh, yeah. When you call Coral Castle, you just ask for his writings, and they'll send you the whole, it'll come in a manila envelope, his five books and his book In Every Home, which describes, you know, how to brush your teeth, how to raise your children, everything about life you need to know according to Ed. Those will all come in.
How to brush your teeth, really?
Oh, I'm telling you, when you read this book, you, a lot of people have said, after you read this book, you'll know why Agnes jilted him.
Why she never showed up.
Why she never showed up. I didn't even go into this in my writing, because I felt like this was his private book. But he talks about some wild things in there. I don't know if I should go into it on the air. It wasn't really dirty, but it was just really.
Are you telling me Ed Leedskalnin also was a little on the strange side?
Well,
kinky side?
If you don't mind, I'll give you a prime example. When he's talking about the Sweet 16, he's talking about a brand new girl, it says. Okay? He's referring to a virgin. All right? And he said that when people arranged picnics, back in these days they arranged picnics and you had church gatherings and stuff, he said some people would sneak around the trees and kiss and play around. And he said, so these picnics and these things that you actually do actually encourage boys to get girls he called dirty, okay? And he said the way he wanted to solve this was, he said, if your mothers want to let them do that, then the mothers should become experimental stations. Meaning, don't mess the young girls up. You're already messed up, so let the boys come and experiment on you. And one of the guys describes it, and he laughs, and he says, well, this was just, got to remember Ed was born in 1887, and there was a lot of different thinking at that time.
Well, so he wasn't being overly strange. He was basically being somewhat traditional, I guess.
He was traditional for the times, but you know, when you read that today, everybody kind of freaks out and says, well, he was a male chauvinist, you know, and you know, he had a repentance corner there in Coral Castle where he had a place for the children to stick their head in. When they were bad, he was not going to spank them, but he was going to sit inside there, and he kind of wedged them in like the old-timey gallows, you know, like they did in the old days. And he also had an opening there for Agnes, and he said, this is in case, he called it the sassy hole. He said, if she gets sassy with me, I'm going to put her in this hole, and then I'm going to lecture her from the other side, okay?
I mean, you're right. Now yeah. We know why she jilted him at the altar.
So, well, on one of the tours, and he didn't like people interrupting, but on one of the tours, he was describing this, and a lady kind of popped up, sort of an arrogant lady, and she said, well, Agnes's hole is there, but where's your hole in case you get sassy with Agnes? And this was kind of the time when women were getting the voting rights, you know, in the 20s, and everybody kind of, you know, gasped, and he said, well, ma'am, he said, now, you know, I made the castle, and I'm kind of the king of the castle, and I feel like the king of the castle should have the right to determine who goes to the sassy hole. And she said, well, I don't think that's right. And she said, now we know why Agnes never married you. And everybody in the audience kind of gasped, and they went, oh. And he handled it real cool. He just kind of grinned, and he said, okay, ma'am. He said, tell you what, since you put it that strongly, I will consider adding my own sassy hole. So
I love it. Let's go to some calls. By the way, I'm getting a lot of fast blasts from people trying to guess what these secret numbers mean. And it ranges from, it's the phone number of his bookie in Latvia. He bet on Latvian horse tracks. It's a bank account. It's amazing. I mean, they just go on and on and on.
You need to write a book on that, George.
Let's go to the phones. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning. Is that John? Is your name?
Joe.
It's Joe.
Joe.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. Joe, by the way, you sound like the fella that George played the other night that laughs at when the women get out and beat up the guy. You sound exactly like him. I'm sitting here dying saying this has got to be him.
Right. He does sound a little like him.
And when he breaks up laughing, he hits me that way. So I'm sitting here laughing. I'm getting killed here.
Well, he must be from the swamp like I am.
I'm telling. Are you from Florida?
Yes, I'm from near. Yeah, I'm up in northern Florida near the Georgia border where Okefenokee Swamp is.
Okay, I'm a little more south down by Palm Beach.
Right.
And a friend of mine convinced me to go down to the Carl Castle. And it was the most, I'm not a tourist guy, no way, no how.
Right.
But it took him 5 years to convince me to go down there with him. And he's into structural engineering and so forth. And he was most taken back by one piece. This is really like a two-part question statement. One has to do with Tesla. Did he have any interaction or knowledge from Tesla? Because when I asked the man who gives you the tour, he was very reluctant to talk about it, almost in a CIA way. Kind of, you know, he struck me that way, like we can't really talk about this, and da da da. It was very odd. But the question I wanted to ask is, you know, there's a 20-ton doorway that can still be moved, like with the push of your finger. That doorway that's on like a pinion or drilled straight through, like it's the shape of a cereal box with softened edges, rounded edges, and it's a 20-ton doorway that just goes around and around and around as if you were to stick something right through a the long way through a cereal box shape, and it's 20 tons, and you could just go to one side or go to the other, and either way it'll move. And all these years, it's still perfectly pivoted, so you can push it with one finger. And he gave us a tour of the whole place. That struck me. Another thing struck me, where did this man, who was made of bones, ever get comfortable? Because when you sit or you touch anything there, you will cut yourself. This man had to be made of iron. So he was really, it was really the most fascinating day I had with my friend. But at the end of the day, we did feel that there was no special knowledge and that it can be figured out through structural engineering and tripods and various things. But there were things left unexplained, and we accepted that too. But so the question comes down to, if you know anything about the door and do you know anything about him communicating with Tesla, I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
George, you want to? My research, I found nothing where he actually interacted with Tesla. So many people have asked me that. I could never determine. Tesla was really farther ahead on Ed. In fact, George, if you remember in the In Search Of show, they actually showed Tesla took a 1931 Pierce Arrow car, took Ed's machine, put it in the car, and it was going 90 miles an hour on an electric motor. As far as the gate that you're talking about, now that gate actually weighs 9 tons. It's not 20 tons. That gate is, and if you were there 5 years ago, that gate is now broken again. It's not working. It takes all your strength now to push it around. And one thing they don't tell you, they had to remove that gate. George and I talked about it last time. In 1986, the weight of the bearings crushed it. Ed had to find the center of gravity of it, which when the University of Florida came down to fix it, their engineers said it would take laser technology to find the center of gravity of the stone. Now, much less without electricity, how did he drill that hole perfectly down the center of the stone?
Right.
And it connects to the wheel bearings, of a Ford truck.
And does it pivot that easily?
Oh, it did. You could a little girl they showed, if you remember my book, could push it with one hand. But now, when the bearings crushed it in 86, they fixed it again, and about 5 years ago, or I guess more recently, it's broken again. It's crushed the wheel bearings again. And what they don't tell you is when they replace the gate, George, you know, on either side there's only 1/4 inch clearance. When the man was explaining that door pivots, there's 1/4 inch with a 9-ton gate. If you were to stick your fingers in there, they're going to be crushed, okay? They had to cut the walls of Coral Castle to fit the new gate, to get it in there, and they don't tell you that on the tour.
Well, now I have, by the way, the officer directors of the Coral Castle, which could very well be the shareholders who, in theory, then would control this corporation, two individuals out of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
Joe,
mm-hmm.
Irving Barr and Lynn Barr,
mm-hmm.
And it's got their address and everything, so... they could very well be the owners, the major shareholders of this corporation, and their registered agent. Looks like it could be an attorney in Bell Harbor, Florida. So what do you think of that? Huh? There you go.
I think you're right on the nose there.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, gentlemen. Great show. I got into Coral Castle. I saw the show on the Travel Channel a few years back, and it just, I guess, anybody who's been completely driven towards something, it just really took over like that. I went on the internet and started looking up everything. I started reading everything, magnetism, everything sort of related. And I was led to a site of a gentleman named John Searle. I was wondering if you're familiar with him. He is credited with coming up with a thing called the Searle disc. And reportedly, I believe it was back in the 50s or 40s, and he was allegedly making his own flying saucers at home. And he took some magnetic coils. He basically, it sounds like he was doing a similar type of thing that Ed was doing, but he took two magnetic coils and put them on a disc, one on top and one on the bottom, and it basically created the same effect you were talking about. The magnets get going, and these saucers would shoot up into outer space and never come back down. I was wondering if you have any familiarity with that, or is it the same principle as what Ed was using?
George, you want to handle that? I've never heard of the gentleman.
No, nor have I.
No, okay.
So I can't answer that.
Okay, well, as I said, I went to coralcastle.com. I just started finding everything in magnetism, but the gentleman's name is John Searle, S-E-A-R-L-E. That may be something you want to look up, or you know, maybe find someone who does know about it. But if people can make flying saucers, hey, that might be something that is worth looking into.
That sounds certainly feasible, and Ed was, you know, I think working in that same type of technology. And George, I think there was a guy named, it was Lazar or whatever, who actually
Lazar.
Thought,
yep.
Yeah, who worked at Area 51, and he said when he got to look at that UFO that it was a magnetic type thing that was running the thing. So whether we can believe that or not, I don't know, but I think that technology is certainly the way it goes.
I got a phone number to the owner of Coral Castle, or the shareholder. We'll call him tomorrow, Joe, and we'll see if he wants to come on the show for a little bit to talk about why he invested or bought it, and we'll go from there.
Boy, that would be wonderful.
What if he said that they found the secrets of Tesla when they owned it?
Well, one of the stories that I was told was he bought it as a wedding or a Valentine gift for his wife because, you know, the Valentine table there that Ed did. So he was kind of being romantic, and he actually bought it for his wife when he was first in enamored of the place. And then he said, well, I'll give her a wedding gift. So that was quite a wedding gift.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi. Is this George Norrie?
Yes, it is, and it's your turn.
Okay, thank you. I don't understand with the intelligence of the listeners that you have and the intelligence of the two of you that it is not cut and dry obvious what's going on, because it is to me.
Tell me what
First
you think
of all,
it is.
The numbers, all the numbers that he's giving you, what are the last three numbers? 1, 9, 5.
Right.
Everything is on that degree, on that dimension, it's on 19.5.
19.5, right.
Exactly. So they're all latitude, longitude numbers, and 19.5 is the number that is your final number. And as far as the Coral Castle is, what nobody can see or tell, but just consider this widely because you'll understand completely. The Coral Castle owner is building a gateway, a portal, and the reason they can't find everything is because a portion of the portal is gone, no different than the stones at Stonehenge, and this castle has to be built in a certain place like the pyramids, because when you put those two angles together, it creates a portal for them to pass through. And it wasn't Agnes, a girl who lives here, but Agnes through the portal back home.
Now, that is an interesting theory. Now, tell me why you've come up with this.
Actually, I listen to your show every night I get a chance, and I've been listening to it and I'm a newbie, for like 2 years.
Okay.
And 19.5, I remember them saying.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is Richard Hoagland talks about
right.
that.
Right. It's like I remember the number, and I don't know why, but whenever I heard the beginning of the numbers, and it ended in 19.5, it's another dimension that is a spot. It's a place. Yeah, it's an intersection that everything comes to, like the other mysterious.
Well, I got to tell you, Joe, and Robin, your theory is as good as any we've heard, a portal to somewhere. How about that? We'll be back with final questions on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Joe, before we take final calls, tell us about your book, Waiting for Agnes, where you can get it. And again, it is fiction based on fact. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, George. You can reach me. I'm going to go ahead and give my telephone number out in case anybody has a pen and paper there. I'm happy to take telephone orders. I'm at area code 386-752-1059. And my email is joebull, joebull, at atlantic.net. And my website is it's just the title of the book, waitingforagnes.com. And so you can email me or call me. Again, that telephone number, 386-752-1059. Call me anytime.
And you'll give them a signed copy?
Oh, yes. All my copies are autographed.
All right, very good. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. George, not tooting my own horn here, but because of when you first did that first show, the hardcover sold out, and anybody that's got a copy of the hardcover, hold on to it. In some areas, it's selling for $1,000 a copy.
Are you kidding?
$1,100.86.
You didn't get it.
I don't get it. I don't get it. Believe it or not, they're putting it on eBay. They're stealing it out of the libraries that I donated the books to and putting it on eBay. A fellow just called me the other day, and he paid $485 for the new soft cover that I sell for $19 on eBay because people can't find me. I'm not in the chain stores. I'm not at Coral Castle. I'm the only one you can get it from, and people don't realize it. So they're paying exorbitant amount of money, even for a soft cover book.
You become a collector yourself, basically.
I used to give the books away. I think they're in horse stalls. People propped up their doors with them. I'd like to have those books back now if they'd send them to me.
How many did you publish originally?
I only published 1,000 copies. There's only 1,000 copies of the original hardback out there.
All right, let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Eric from New London, Connecticut. I got a quick question on the text which Ed wrote about the magnetic fields and stuff. From what I understand, he actually wrote in their designs to create a perpetual energy storage device using a couple of magnets and some wire. And from what I understand, some of the tests he did, he put the two magnets together using a certain technique and energized them through the wire. And then he'd just leave them sitting around for a while, and he'd be able to discharge it days, months, even years later, and still get enough charge out of this thing that's just been sitting around to light up a light bulb. And this is all based off his writings in the magnetic book, a lot of which he says the only actual theory that matters is the one of electromagnetism, and that it is the only actual force in the universe. There aren't like the gravity or the strong and weak nuclear. There's just the electromagnetic. And everything we see is pretty much just a breakdown of that. So my question is, have you seen anything in your research of Coral Castle or anything like that that would indicate he used some kind of electromagnetism in order to not only move and form the stones, but to do things like cut the shaft for the 9-ton swinging door and essentially everything like that?
George, the only thing I can say regarding that, there's nothing that would indicate it that you know if he did it like that, which we think he did, there's nothing in there. He left nothing behind, only those books on the magnetic current, and I've tried to read that, and I think, reader, you've gotten a lot more out of it than I did. It's very difficult to understand, and I don't have any knowledge as far as him, you know, charging those things and coming back days later. That would be news to me.
Yeah, from what I understand, it was a very technical thing he started working on, which is one of the ways that led him to be able to do things like the castle itself. One of the things I did gather from my reading of that is a lot of the electromagnetism stuff he did could also be used to lift the stones off the ground kind of thing. Some people will occasionally talk about pulleys, but the amount that he'd need and the height they'd have to be at in order to move the stones himself or pretty much unmanageable. So I just wanted to know if you had seen any kind of devices around there that people might have uncovered or something that lead you to believe something along those lines.
No, I wish I could. I wish I could uncover that. But I think you're absolutely right. I think you're on the right track there. We just haven't found out exactly how he did it. There's theories like we discussed before with the Christopher Dunn idea of him levitating those stones. But that's the only theories that I've seen that, you know, actually might explain how he did that.
And he was listening to us on our brand new affiliate, New London, Connecticut, WXLM-FM. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing today? First-time caller. I love your show, George.
Well, thank you very much.
I've got a two-part question. My first part of the question is, has anybody ever actually weighed any of those stones to back up the weight for what they're saying? Because some of those stones, to me, don't look quite as heavy as what they're saying. Has anybody ever weighed those?
No, there's actually never been a survey where they actually weigh them because, you know, it's just how would you get in there to weigh them? You know, it's all based on, you know, basically theory. In fact, I had, this was given to me from another person. Now, it says the weight of the stones is calculated by figuring out what 1 cubic foot weighed, and then you would multiply the total cubic feet.
Right.
And that's the weight pretty much is determined, and then, of course, it's estimated. Nothing is actually, you know, you can't put them really on a scale and weigh them.
Uh-huh. Are they saying that coral is like heavier than natural stone per cubic foot or lighter?
I couldn't tell you that. I don't know that.
Okay. Now, do they know where he is actually, like how he quarried and cut those stones, like what location and how he actually cut them and split them?
There is actually when they were doing Coral Castle, they actually covered up most of his quarry spots because of the danger of people falling into the pits.
Now, was that in Florida City or was that in Homestead?
In Homestead right now. When you go down there right now, as you walk into the castle, to the right of the castle, there's one quarry bed, and you can actually see where the stones were taken out of the ground. It's kind of interesting. There's no chisel marks or anything that you can really tell on the stones, but most of the other quarry beds were covered up to keep people from falling in. So there's only one spot there where you can actually walk to the castle and you can step down into the bed. It's actually about a 3-foot drop where he quarried those original stones.
So nobody really knows how he cut them, the blocks out of the main coral.
They cannot. George and I talked about that last time. We talked about all kinds of ideas. You know, how do you get underneath once you cut it to get the horizontal cut? You know, even if you get a vertical cut, how do you cut the bottom? The idea is that he got a big thing and popped them out of there. But how you pop a 30-ton stone is, you know, beyond me.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Yes, sir.
I mean, that is a great question. How do you cut the bottom?
Right.
And then lift these huge blocks of stone up.
And George, if you look at those stones, now the caller earlier that said he was down there said, you know, this coral will cut you. But now I had a different experience down there. When you sit on these chairs and there's beds down there that, you know, he said he and Agnes would sleep on, these stones are cut, George, with a precision that's as smooth as your skin. I mean,
what do you mean he and Agnes would sleep on? Where did Agnes come in from?
Well, because remember now, he's building this for his future life with Agnes and the children. So there's actually beds down there, you know, and he said one time, if Agnes complains about the living conditions, I'm going to tell her, well, at least you don't have to worry about sweeping the floor.
But you meant where they would sleep.
Where they would
you
sleep.
You said where she was. I thought you popped up all of a sudden.
I'm sorry. I got carried away there. No, where the future would be. So he actually put beds there, and as he was giving a tour, he said, you know, here's where the – in fact, he had a little rocker there for the baby and the little bedroom there where she would, you know, rock the baby. And so it's all there. But those stones are cut with – absolutely, they're smooth.
As smart as he was, as much of a genius as he had to have been, was he insane?
No. No, not at all.
I mean, just think of this for a moment, Joe. Here's a guy, regardless of his technology and the knowledge of, here's a guy – who's building a house for a woman who's not coming or maybe doesn't exist, beds for children that aren't there. I mean, it's almost as if this was all a figment of his imagination. I mean, that's kind of weird. I mean, if I went out and built a house for someone who I don't really know and started putting in, you know, here's the kid's room and here are the beds for the kid, and that's kind of weird.
Well, he just didn't have to go through a divorce, George.
No, that's but they weren't there.
Well, but see, thing is, now, Ed was eccentric, okay? I'll give you that. He was eccentric. But don't forget, as we talked about it last time, the Agnes story is also a great cover for his scientific achievements, because when he was beaten by those thugs, he actually did not talk about his machine too much anymore. He didn't talk about his scientific, so he had to cover his things. So that whole Agnes story, now I'll tell you a funny thing. When he moved from Florida City to Homestead, okay, one of his friends noticed he changed from the love story to more of a scientific story. He actually changed the layouts. The first coral castle he built in Florida City was all about love. Now, when he gets beaten up and he makes the move to Homestead, his friend asked him, he said, hey, Ed, well, how come you don't talk as much about Agnes on the tours? I mean, you don't mention it. You don't speak with it with the fervent right. enthusiasm. And said, what happened to Agnes? Where is she? And his comment was, I left her down in Florida City, so I don't talk about her much anymore.
I left her down in Florida City.
I left her down in Florida City.
Maybe he meant emotionally.
Yeah, he did. He was cutting his ties, okay? And don't forget, this was his way. You know, some people go to drink, some people take drugs. You know, Ed's way to get over his grief and to prove to the world that he was not, you know, a bad guy or anything, was to do this. And so he worked instead of doing anything else. So I look at him as a marvelous, romantic, eccentric. But I don't think he was not insane at all, no.
All right, let's go to our West of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
I'm calling the show.
Yes, sir.
Running out of effort, wasting my time. I'm put on hold, and then I get cut off.
Well, you're on the air now. Do you have a question?
Is anybody there?
No, nobody's here, including
obviously,
you.
Unbelievable.
Next question.
Yeah. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Good morning, George and Joe.
Thank you.
This is George from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Great, George.
I happen to be Latvian and have personally spent 25, 30 years.
My friend George.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Joe. I've
George
been
Nair.
Waiting to meet you in person to talk to you several times by email and phone.
Great. Great to talk to you.
Oh, yeah, and I also have the privilege of being the English editor of a new book coming out about Ed, written by a fellow in Latvia, another Latvian. And therefore, I can tell you what the secret of the numbers is, if you'd like to.
Wow. Why not? Absolutely. And also tell us the secret of how he did this.
Well, that's a different story. But the numbers, actually, not to disappoint anybody, there's quite a simple explanation for them. And I have the documents to show it. That was a number off a federal form for his application as a citizen to the United States. If you remember, or in this particular case, he was an illegal alien, an early illegal alien. He had come in illegally in the United States and worked. And so when he was in Florida, and this could have been one of his concerns about being beat up, especially during the war, he did put the application in, and the federal form had this number on it. And my understanding is that a lot of immigrants that came over in those early years used to inscribe these numbers on their doorway to sort of let inspectors and people know who they were and that they had a status, much like an ID would, you know, we'd have today. So that's actually the secret. I know some people out there, and one guy spent many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of hours researching it. But I hope that doesn't burst too many people's bubbles. But that's
why would he call it the secret of the universe?
Hey, I don't believe he ever said that. That was somebody who put that tag on there, to be quite honest. That was just his mark, you know, just like you'd have your address, and that was to be known, this is my place. This is who I am, and I'm a U.S. citizen.
Does your friend from Latvia have his own theories on how he thinks Ed did what he did?
A lot of the book is historical. I did also get introduced to one of Ed's relatives. An older gentleman in his 70s, and I went and visited his farm in Latvia, not far from where Ed grew up. And interesting enough, he had tripods, and he was showing me how to lift things and move things. But that doesn't really explain some of the mystery and the focus on the physics, I guess, for lack of a better term, that Ed certainly spent his time writing about. You notice that in his literature, in his printed literature, he never talked much about building or construction. It was all about, not counting, of course, the book In Every Home, which was more about life.
What about the machine, George?
That's an interesting machine. It's a very interesting machine, isn't it? I wish it was a little bit protected so people wouldn't chip at it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. And let us know when this book comes out, too.
Serious draft in English conversion has been done. It's probably ready in the next couple of months.
Okay. Sounds like we might have a roundtable discussion, Joseph.
Sounds great.
On Ed Leeds' call, then. We'll get everybody together on something like that. That would be interesting. It'd be a fascinating program.
Thank you, George. Thank you.
I wonder if we could ever get the relative on the line. That would be interesting, too.
That would be.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. Go ahead, sir.
Hello, George. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Joe, I think I know what the number is above Ed's door.
Okay.
It's the golden ratio expressed numerically.
Hmm.
The golden ratio is what we find in seashells on the beach. It's a pattern identified in most designs, usually underlying. But apparently this gentleman, Ed, figured it out mathematically and was able to use it to affect electromagnetism, which is fascinating.
See, I like that theory better than it being his citizen number.
Yes, I heard that other call, and that may be his citizen's number, if there were such a thing as coincidence. But it wouldn't explain how he was able to do what he did. But knowing the golden ratio, being able to express it mathematically would definitely account for being able to do what this gentleman has done.
And did you say, excuse me, did you say it was based on seashell? Is that what I heard you say?
Well, the golden ratio is found in most designs. It's a design that's of nature, and the seashell just happens to be in the golden ratio. If you looked at enough ads, you would see that.
Oh, my God. Can I interrupt you here a second, George? This is something that the altar at Coral Castle, that's where the strange face, some people call it a monkey face, some people call it an alien face. And when I was doing research, if you go to that picture and look at that altar, it is surrounded with seashells.
That is fascinating. Now, I like that theory.
Covered in seashells, in the big conch-looking shells.
We're coming up to the end here, and many people still want the number sequence, so I shall give it again.
Thank you for that caller. That's wonderful.
7129/6105195. So it's 7129/6105195. We've heard all kinds of theories tonight. Joe Bullard, the greatest part of Ed Leedskalnin, he keeps us wondering, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Thanks,
God.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate you being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.